Okay. In your 2005 TED Talk on the new open source economics, you say that decisions are being made about the future of the freedom to be as social beings with each other and the way information, knowledge, and culture will be produced. You also say that a battle is being fought about how difficult it will be for new models of production to develop alongside the industrial information economy. Since then, we have seen a lot of development and many power shifts. Where do we stand now in the battlefield?
That's a broad and deep question. I think there are three main dimensions that I would focus on. The first is the one that is most urgent and immediate in the middle of June of 2013 with the revelations of the NSA spying program. And that is the increasing or risk of a public-private partnership of social control, where on the one hand we have increasingly dominant small number of firms controlling a very large number of the basic capabilities of online life. And on the other hand, we have governments that are becoming more sophisticated about using the tools of network life as a mode of surveillance and as a mode of control. What we've seen with the NSA's prison program and the Verizon order that just came out in the middle of June 2013 is that these two enormous capabilities are now feeding each other in what Neva Elkin-Corin and Michael Bernhardt called over a decade ago the invisible handshake, the public-private partnership for surveillance. We saw it in the massive multi-layered assault on WikiLeaks in response to the embassy cables when the site suffered an attack from the state through the DNS provider, even the Apple App Store, but most importantly, the funding system. And that increased sophistication of firms and the state and the combination between the two of them presents a significant deep threat to the possibility of shared social life on the net, developing free of the power of the providing companies and the state in combination. The second major threat to the possibility of open, collaborative, engaged life on the net with the levels of autonomy that we could have hoped for, predicted that were part of the battle in the middle of the first decade of the 21st century, is the transition to the handheld device. We had essentially two platforms. One was the personal computer, which was largely built on an open environment. Open APIs, even Microsoft had open APIs. Certainly the development of free software made those even more free up above the physical layer. And on the other hand, the phone was a very limited platform. What's happened with the rise of the smartphone and the shift of computation to the handheld is that the history of the handheld, the connection between the carrier, the non-open IP stack, the business models, the ties to the handheld device, and the customer relationship in the sense that there's a crisp, curated experience have meant that the move to the smartphone has created substantial risk that the range of freedom, that the degrees of freedom in the platform will be substantially constrained, and that we will see the development of a much more closed, proprietary, programmed platform, sort of a TV on steroids and on the go, rather than an open network. I don't think that's finished. I don't think that's over. I think the fact that we're seeing a massive rise in the use of Wi-Fi now will open up the question of what sort of platforms will go. It may break the power of the carriers, but that technological, industrial, cultural conglomeration of characteristics that typify the handheld and the market of, for the handheld risks undermining the basic platforms. And the third and final set of battles continued to be the reassertion of intellectual property. We had the major battles in the late 90s. We had the hiatus of the mid-2000s. And really, we've seen initially with ACTA, then with change with SOPA PIPA in the United States, with the TPP now in the Pacific, we'll see now with the European-American Free Trade Agreement, we're seeing a whole new set of efforts to clamp down on intellectual property and constrain the commons in a way that really threatens open commons-based production. So these are the great threats. The great hope or source of hope is that we're seeing a broader and deeper acceptance of open peer production and collaboration as a basic fact of life. If 5 or 6 years ago we still need to argue about the sustainability and plausibility of models of engaged collaboration as the a core stable form of being, I think today it's taken for granted as a core solution space. So that's the tension, and just like it was 6 or 7 years ago, it's still too soon to tell.
Okay. Eric Fromm, in his book To Have or To Be, describes two states of men. The having mode, which focuses on material possessions and power, and is the source of evil, and the being mode, which is centered on love, sharing, and productive activity. Fromm describes the conditions for human change and the features of the new man. One of these features is the joy that comes from giving and sharing, not from hoarding and exploiting. Where do you see the balance between the having mode and the being mode in our contemporary society? What conditions are needed for commons-based peer production to flourish? And where do you see the threats?
One of the most remarkable intellectual shifts we've seen in the last 15 years is the dramatic expansion of space across multiple disciplines for an understanding of cooperation as central to human being. In 1976, Richard Dawkins in The Selfish Gene called, if we want a society that is built on altruism, we need to teach altruism because we're born selfish. He wasn't being wrong for the time. He was describing the state of the discipline in evolutionary biology in the mid-70s. By 2006, Martin Novak in Science wrote, perhaps the most amazing thing about evolution is its ability to develop cooperation in a competitive world. We might add natural cooperation as a fundamental element of evolution alongside natural selection. That's a fundamental change in that discipline. But it also happened in economics, even, where we've seen tremendous rise of work on cooperation. The Ernst Fayer's group in Zurich is at the center of this. Sam Bowles, Herb Gintis. We've seen the same thing happen in political science with the work of Eleanor Ostrom. We've seen it in organizational sociology. There's been a tremendous arc over the last 15 years of recovering from 40 years of perfection of self-interested rationality and the rise and dominance of scientific selfishness, and its displacement by an increasing recognition in science of the centrality of the cooperative spirit to human relations. This is occurring alongside a time when we're seeing millions of people engaged in their day-to-day activities in behaviors that are cooperative. And instead of being happening on an intellectual background that ignores these and tells and thinks of them as peripheral, it's occurring on the on an intellectual and cultural framing that embraces sharing and supports it. So people can engage in these practices with a self-understanding that that's what they're doing, and therefore actually as something that becomes seen and habituated as a virtue. You ask about the threat. As with any other cultural moment, there's the threat of capture. As you sit around here, you see the T-Mobile advertisement, life is sharing. There's the risk of trivialization. There's the risk that the potential of sharing becomes just something you sell. It's like Nike took over the concept of just do it. They took the 60s notion of sort of breaking convention and turned it into essentially a marketing device. So there's the constant concern that the same set of ideas will be turned into words to be sold. And the moment of self-understanding of the cooperative spirit and the spirit of actually being able to make and do in cooperation with each other is lost. I'm a moderate optimist on this. I think that the maker movement is really very interesting. I think that the way in which people have shifted from doing passive consumption on TV to active participation as a way of being and doing in the world is becoming more common, and I'd say probably wider spread in wider generation in younger generations. So on this, I am something of an optimist, but not an unalloyed optimist.
You mentioned the selfish gene. The next question goes a bit in that direction as well. So in your latest book, The Penguin and the Leviathan, you discuss selfishness versus human capabilities to cooperate. And you argue that even though people behave selfishly some of the time, they are not concerned with self-interest all of the time. And you claim that people care about what is right and fair and normal, and that human potential for cooperation is in fact greater than we assume. So how does the discussion about selfishness and the potential to cooperate translate to the realm of science?
Science is complicated. Science is complicated because at one level it's an intensely cooperative exercise. At another level, our scientific system is set up very much as a competitive framework. The awards, the prizes, the professorships, the publications, the limits on funding and grants. So I think there's a real tension between, on one hand, the kind of character who goes into academic science as opposed to commercial science, who is oriented toward inquiry, and the organizational structure that is very much built on status and competition. It's not clear that we can resolve those. And there's wonderful work, for example, not that new, it's over a decade old, by Woody Powell and Jason Owen Smith on the interesting fact that biotech scientists tend to actually be in some sense more open with each other than academic scientists, because academic scientists operate under conditions of scarcity of a certain kind. I think it's very hard to find in contemporary, certainly biological sciences, the same Mertonian values. But I think it also differs from science to science. I think computer science is one example of a place where you see a lot of cooperation and relative openness and exchange of information with the competition. I think it's important to recognize that we're diversely motivated, not just cooperative or just selfish. And I think it's those diverse motivations that a well-structured system can employ together. And I also think that we are diverse. We're beginning, I think, to find that we're diverse as among ourselves. Some people are more oriented toward, say, social signaling, and others are more oriented toward reciprocity. And the construction of different pockets within science that are optimized towards one or another may be the next stage in which we really think carefully about how we structure the motivational models. That said, even when we're in a competitive science framework and where we're looking at some form of social status seeking and therefore relatively harder cooperation in the early stage, there's a very strong commitment to open science because there's the tension between getting first to publication, but then publication and dissemination. And so I think you see, and Fiona Murray's work on this is perhaps empirically the most robust, you see a real benefit to open science in terms of its ability to facilitate publication and facilitate diffusion. And then the cooperation becomes more serial and less directly engaged. But I do think that there's a real tension, even within science, between the Mertonian utopia and values and the practice of actual competitive engagement alongside cooperation.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about a bit more about open science. The open access movement has gained momentum. There are experiments around new forms of scientific publication models, and there is an increasing pressure on sharing data. So if we consider open science in the sense of making the whole research process, not just its end results, more transparent and accessible, where do you see the up and downsides? And also, does openness in science provide us with a new degree of freedom?
So open access publication has got to happen. It will happen. There are very strong powers, science, nature being obviously the clearest examples, pulling against it, and with the power to pull against it. But the success of PLOS One is really showing us the way. The success of open access publication in computer science and physics, we really are seeing the biological sciences as the one that are dragging their feet the most. And I think that's just a question of time. Open data. Similarly, I think that the core values and the requirements by the funding agencies, both public and increasingly now private, to make the data open will drive us toward open data. I think we're seeing a very curious assault with these open data, essentially fake journals that are vanity presses that end up using publication fees as their model of fees. I think that's an attack, like any other scam in any other market. Open publication is like a market. It's open. People will do it. Some people will come and try to take to exploit the vulnerabilities of the system. But now that we know about it, I suspect people will just be more. This is at the moment in the middle of 2013. It looks like a threat, but I suspect that it's a it's going to be an annoyance, at worst, like spam, that is to say persistent, nasty annoyance that we deal with, but not something that fundamentally brings down the system. And at best, people will just learn not to open the malware and not use it. The question of open science for society is more a question of longer-term consequence. Oh. You wanted to talk about limitations of open data sharing. There I see that the social sciences are the ones where there's the greatest ambivalence, because the more that we move toward computational social science that gives us enormous power in trying to understand human behavior, the more complex it becomes to share the data after the analysis in a completely open way while preserving appropriate anonymity and privacy for the subject. So there's a real human subject constraint tension between open data particularly in social science. It's less of a problem with experimental data on humans. Once you actually are able to do the experimental work well, it's very easy to anonymize the subject. But in computational social science, because of the size of the data and the degree to which we're able to capture so many behaviors that are very hard to de-individuate, that's a real and I think going to be a long-term tension between the requirements of open science and the requirement of human dignity. And that's not obviously solvable. We may well have to have some real barriers to access in terms of the responsibility and filtering of who gets to use the data and the kinds of obligations they'll have to undertake and the kind of review they'll have to undertake in order to assure human subjects protection. That's one area where I see a real basic long-term tension of values. Impact on society, like everything else, open. If we do it well, we'll get more of it, we'll get better of it, and that's a good thing. Open access publication, there's obviously the hope that you'll get better information, particularly in poorer countries where the cost of manuscripts and journals is just too high to get decent access to libraries. Similarly with open data, the fact that you'll have more people all over the world being able to look at problems is potentially significant in terms of its improvement overall. I think, though, that in terms of really big differences, it's going to be more on opening up the set of forms of inquiry outside of traditional science and toward more engaged inquiry. Just think of agronomic science instead of as biotech, as all farmers actually being able on local and regional levels to share information locally. That seems to me to be of a more potentially significant societal transformation rather than simply an improvement within science. But broadly speaking, it's the same benefit of increased rapid improvement and higher quality in science that openness provides once you actually have information shared.
Final question. Do you have a vision of a future centered on internet and society? Where are the current developments taking us?
Like Chilin Lai said of the French Revolution, too soon to tell. I think we're a little more mature today than we were 5 to 10 years ago. I think we see the threats more clearly in terms of the reassertion of a small number of firms and a core set of governments of being able to actually domesticate the network, domesticate the energy of citizens on the net. And that's the class of risks, that the moment of openness that we experienced in the first decade of the 21st century was that moment when the technology caught aggregations of power by surprise, such that we were able to see new developments. The most utopian version is the question of what happens with 3D printing or distributed fabrication. Because the critical change that computer-mediated network information production introduced was the radical decentralization of capital in the domain of information, knowledge, and cultural production. If we get a parallel radical distribution of capitalization in the material production of stuff, things get very interesting. And they don't necessarily get interesting good, right? Manufacturing jobs go away. What do people do? Food doesn't, but most material stuff does. That becomes very interesting and different. So if I were to see the next radical shift in the organization of work, in the organization of concentrations of material wealth, in the capacity for people to come together and build things for each other, that would be the dimension that would essentially replicate in the material world what we saw in the information world. But the truth is, we're simply in a moment that is more mature, and as it's more mature, it also is more open to contestation from the large aggregations, both commercial and state-based, against this increasingly excited and self-conscious social force that we've seen in this 10 to 15 years when the incumbents were asleep, grown, recognized itself in the mirror and said, this is how I want to be. And now it's in real tension with the forces that are learning how to constrain, contain, manipulate, control. We're in a new decade of a new struggle. I think one of the things we may learn is that struggle is what there is. There's no equilibrium. All there is a sense of yourself able to do, alone and with others, things for yourself, able to bob and weave between all sorts of sources of constraints that others are trying to put on you, and continuously being vigilant of trying to find new ways of preserving spaces of freedom in between these efforts to constrain. And this sense of continuous opportunity and threat and continuous skepticism about the possibility that things will stabilize and all will be secure may be the new condition. It's not necessarily the most attractive of conditions, but it is one that, as we come to understand, at least we'll know where the threats are coming and where the possibilities to negotiate a degree of freedom will come from.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Great, thanks.
Great, thank you. You can use